13. The Stresemann era was not a great epoch. It was not a complete success even while it lasted. Too much trouble rumbled below the surface. Too many evil, diabolic forces stirred perceptibly in the wings, bound and gagged for the moment, but not really destroyed. No great symbol was raised that might exorcise the demons. The period remained one without passion, without greatness, without full conviction in its own cause. The old patriotic, bourgeois, peace-loving, liberal views returned to favour, but they had the unmistakable air of stopgaps, of being there faute de mieux and until further notice. It was not a time that could later be recalled as the great past, in contrast to a dark present, but as a modest epoch of restoration. And yet, Talleyrand said that those who had not lived before 1789 had never known the sweetness of life. Elderly Germans have made similar claims for the days before 1914. It would sound a little ridiculous to say anything so extravagant about the Stresemann era. For all that, it was, despite its failings, for us young Germans the best period of our lives. All that we have experienced of the sweetness of life is associated with it. It was the only time when life was set in a major and not a minor key, even though it was a somewhat pale and hesitant major. It was the only time when we were really able to live. Most young Germans, as has already been said, could not cope with it, or were defeated by it. For the rest of us, this is a period from which we still draw sustenance. It is difficult to speak of things that have never materialized, of beginnings that never got beyond a maybe or an almost. Yet it seems to me that, amid all that dark peril and inhuman evil, something rare and precious did begin to flower in Germany during the Stresemann era. The greater part of the younger generation had been ruined beyond saving, but the remaining minority was perhaps more promising than any generation of the last 100 years. The wild decade of 1914 to 1923 had thrown aside all balance and tradition, but it had also blown away the cobwebs and mental clutter. Most of us emerged as nihilistic cynics. Those who did learn to live again enrolled in an advanced course, as it were, free of the fads and illusions that occupy a sheltered youth. We had not been sheltered, but exposed to raw winds. We were poor, even in traditional spiritual values, but also free from inherited prejudices. We were hard-boiled and tough. If we did not become callous, we were in no danger of becoming soft. If we avoided cynicism, we were not likely to become dreamy Parsifals. Something very fine and auspicious was silently ripening among the best of German youth from 1925 to 1930. A new idealism beyond doubt and disappointment, a new liberalism broader, more comprehensive, and more mature than the political liberalism of the 19th century. Indeed, perhaps the basis of a new nobility of spirit, a new excellence, a new aesthetic of life. It was as yet a long way from realization and influence. Hardly had it been thought of and put into words than the quadrupeds arrived and trampled it all underfoot. Despite everything, one could find a fresh atmosphere in Germany at this time, and there was a remarkable absence of insincere convention. The barriers between the classes had become thin and permeable, perhaps a fortunate byproduct of the universal impoverishment. There were many students who were labourers, and many young labourers who were students. Class prejudice and the starched collar mentality were simply out of fashion. The relations between the sexes were freer and franker than ever, perhaps a fortunate byproduct of the lack of discipline of the past years. Instead of a contemptuous superiority, we felt a bewildered sympathy for previous generations who had, in their youth, had the choice between unapproachable virgins for adoration and harlots for relaxation. Finally, a new hope even began to dawn in international relations. There was less prejudice and more understanding of the other side, and an unmistakable pleasure in the vivid variety that the world derives from its many peoples. Berlin became quite an international city. Admittedly, the sinister Nazi types already lurked in the wings, as we could not fail to notice with deep disgust. They spoke of Eastern vermin, with murder in their eyes, and sneeringly of Americanization. Whereas we, a segment of the younger generation, difficult to define but instantly and mutually recognizable, were not only friendly toward foreigners, but enthusiastic about them. How much more interesting, more beautiful, and richer it made life that the world was not peopled exclusively by Germans. Our guests were all welcome, whether they came voluntarily, like the Americans and the Chinese, or as refugees, like the Russians. Our doors were flung open, the strangers were received with a friendly, curious goodwill, and with a conscious determination to understand and learn to appreciate even what was most foreign to us. In those days, many a friendship, many a love, linked the Far West and Far East. My most treasured and tender memories are associated with just such a local international circle, a bit of the globe in the middle of Berlin. It was a small academic tennis club in which we Germans were scarcely more strongly represented than the other nations. Strangely enough, Frenchmen and Englishmen were rare, but otherwise the entire universe seemed to have sent its envoys. Americans and Scandinavians, Balts and Russians, Chinese and Japanese, Hungarians and people from the Balkans, even a melancholy wag of a Turk. I never found the same free and easy youthful atmosphere again, except perhaps as a casual visitor to the Latin Quarter in Paris. Deep nostalgia overcomes me when I recall the summer evenings we spent after matches in our clubhouse, often far into the night, seated in wicker chairs still in our tennis whites, sipping wine and cracking jokes, engaging in long and eager conversations that had nothing in common with the oppressive political discussions of earlier and later years, and which we sometimes interrupted to play a game of ping-pong, or to put on the gramophone and dance. When I think of those nights today, so full of innocent fun and youthful gravity, of dreams of the future and of universal fellowship and trust, I stop and wonder. I cannot decide whether it is more incredible that all that could have existed in Germany scarcely 10 years ago, or that it has been so thoroughly and completely obliterated in just 10 years. It is to this club, too, that I owe my deepest and most enduring love affair. I think it will not be out of place to mention it here, for it has a generic aspect. It is most certainly a romantic lie, yet one that enjoyed the widest popularity in the last century, that one really loves only once in a lifetime. It is rather futile to seek to compare amorous experiences, which are in essence incomparable, and try to classify them in some order and declare, I loved this or that woman most of all. It is true, however, that at a certain stage in life, about the age of 20, a love affair and the choice of partner affect one's destiny and character more than at others. For the woman one loves stands for more than just herself, a whole view of the world, a notion of life, an ideal, if you will, but one come alive, made flesh and blood. It is the privilege of some youths of 20 to love in a woman what later, as men, they will look upon as their guiding star.